Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, and I have just returned from the Montreal Comedy Festival, and ever since I got back, I've been thinking about aluminum and the Singularity episode with Aaron Frank. If you didn't listen to that episode, Aaron Frank talked about one of the many things he talked about to help explain what exponential acceleration means in relation to technology was he talked about aluminum, and he talked about how at one point in the history of the world, aluminum used to be so incredibly valuable that Napoleon, when he had parties, would serve the most esteemed guests with plates made of aluminum and silverware made of aluminum, and all the other shitheads at the party got to eat off of plates made of gold. And they would sit there with their crappy gold silverware and gold plates and look over at the great guests eating off of aluminum plates with jealousy. Because at the time, aluminum was incredibly expensive to produce. But thanks to technology, they figured out how to make aluminum at a fraction of the cost, and of course Napoleon probably went back to serving his guests on gold. So these poor bastards who probably invested all this money in whatever machinery or equipment they needed to produce the expensive aluminum suddenly found themselves in a predicament very similar to the predicament of Parisian taxi drivers today, and a lot of taxi drivers, which is if you wanted to drive a taxi, you would have to go through all this crazy licensing bullshit, and that was ostensibly placed there to protect the public from unscrupulous taxi drivers. But the reality is that a license is just another is quite often just another name for a bribe. And whatever long process taxi drivers had to go through in Paris to become a taxi driver has been completely subverted by the beautiful technology that is Uber. And we're seeing examples of this in every single industry, including the TV industry, which is why it's really cool to be at a festival where many comedians have come there in the hopes that somebody from the TV industry will give them money to make stuff, which is fine. Unless you've let yourself believe that that's the only way that you can make stuff that has any kind of validity. And a lot of people have tricked themselves. I got in a conversation with somebody, a comedian who was headed over there. And, I was talking to him. He's like, yeah, I don't really do much social networking. But, you know, I think that this is my shot here. Like, this is it, man. I think this is where it's really going to happen at this festival. And it's like, whoa, wait, what's going to happen? Somebody from a network that is creating content that's supremely expensive and time-consuming to make, that gets a fraction of the views of other content being produced by individuals all over the planet, is going to give you some money? That's what you want? You want someone who's a representative of antiquated technology to knight you and to give you some money for which you will exchange your artistic autonomy, and maybe you'll water your vision down a little bit, and then you'll maybe produce some content that will get put up on what is no more than a glorified YouTube channel, and which really might receive might be viewed by far less people than if you just done it yourself. So it's a weird mindset that a lot of people get themselves into. Maybe some of you guys have gotten yourself into that mindset. And it's a totally, it used to be the way things were, man. Back in the 80s and the 90s, that was really how it was. You would be completely dependent on a corporation giving you money if you wanted to get your shit out to the world, because there was no YouTube, no streaming services, no internet. But it's just not like that anymore. And you're not going to hear about that on TV. It's just the entire model has changed. The terrain has changed. In Sun Tzu's Art of War, it says the most important thing is knowing the terrain that you're fighting on. If you don't know the terrain that you're fighting on, you're fucked. And a lot of people right now are still fighting on terrain, or they're fighting using techniques developed for a terrain that no longer exists. And if you're one of those people, then you need to adapt your fighting style. You need to adapt to the terrain that we're currently existing in. And that terrain is a terrain where all you need is, where you need less than $1,000 worth of technology to create the content that formerly used to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to make. So don't let yourself get tricked if you're an artist. Don't let yourself get fooled. Don't get caught up in the ridiculous bureaucratic development process that that people can get sucked into. Don't trick yourself into thinking that you're not procrastinating because you're going to a million meetings every week. That's just procrastination, if you ask me. Going to meeting after meeting after meeting, going to pitch meeting after pitch meeting, or sitting down with groups of people to develop some stuff that that ends up taking years and years to finally get rejected. That's just procrastination. And it's okay. Procrastination is just the manifestation of your fear of success. That's what procrastination is. A lot of people are fucking terrified of succeeding because innately inside of all of us, we know that there's just a general sense of emptiness. So anytime you're working on anything, you're always going to get this weird fraudulent sense that goes along with it. And if you have the power, the potency, or the insane, or if you're delusional enough even, you can do this ridiculous pull-up where you just decide, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to make stuff. I deserve to make stuff. I'm a human on this planet, and I'm going to create stuff, and I'm going to get it out to the world, and I'm not going to wait around for some guy to tell me that I'm good enough to make stuff, because really, you're the only person who can tell you that. You're the network now. Everyone's their own goddamn network these days. You're the network executive, and you've got to give yourself permission to start making stuff right now, if that's what you want to do. If you're not a creator, you just like enjoy listening to stuff, and consuming stuff, that's awesome. You can just enjoy it, and congratulations to you, because this is the golden age of entertainment. There's never been more options for stuff to listen to. There's never been so many information streams in the history of humanity. But if you're a comedian or an actor or somebody who just loves making stuff and getting it in front of people, and you're waiting to do that until somebody who's a representative for an industry that is in the midst of a really tumultuous series of changes to tell you that you're going to be the next star, then you're fucking yourself. Don't do it. You don't need to be knighted by anyone. Those days are gone. There's a great interview with Louis C.K. on David Letterman. And he's talking about getting at the Comedy Store. It used to be that you'd have to perform for Mitzi, the owner of the club. I used to work for her. I drove her around. I was the talent coordinator there, and I remember what it was like. She'd sit in the back. A comedian would get on stage, and if she liked you, she'd make you a paid regular, and you get to work out at the club. Anyway, you can look it up. Louis C.K.'s on Letterman, and he's talking about how he'd been doing stand-up for 20 years, and he got on stage, had barely said anything when the light turned on, indicating that he should get off the stage. He thought there was a mistake and then looked in the back of the room and Mitzi's like waving for him to get off stage. Now, this is Louis C.K., who's now one of the top comedians in the country. Regardless of what you think of him, I love him. I think he's hilarious. He's one of the top fucking comedians right now. But, and if he'd allowed himself to believe that Mitzi Shore or anybody else on planet Earth knew whether or not he could be successful, then he wouldn't have, there would be no Louis C.K. If the moment Mitzi had waved him away, he had allowed that to be a poison dart that stuck in his brain, and he allowed himself to think, shit, man, all this struggle to be a comedian was useless because this woman who has theoretically created so many great comics or been part of their development doesn't like me, then there would be no great comedy from Louis C.K. It would have skulked off somewhere. And anytime you find yourself sitting at the bottom of a pyramid, looking up at someone, hoping they let you live as opposed to sentence you to death, then you have really gotten yourself in a shitty situation. Because you're waiting for a monkey descendant to give you permission to be an artist. Somebody else is in charge. Some, there are three temptations that face Buddha. Three progressive temptations. The first one is Mara, the Lord of the Earth, starts hurling fireballs at the Buddha. This is the fear of death, destruction. And the Buddha laughs and the fireballs turn into flower petals. Then the second temptation the Buddha is faced with is the daughters of Mara. The Lord of the Earth presents Buddha with his beautiful daughters. And a lot of people say this represents like the erotic temptation or the temptation to start a family. But I think it was Chogyam Trungpa who said that actually this temptation is the temptation to believe that you're becoming enlightened and getting lost in the sort of ego game of being a spiritual person, right? That's the second temptation. The third temptation is one of the most curious temptations, which is where Mara, the Lord of the Earth, says to Buddha, why do you think you get to be the Buddha? Why do you deserve to be the Buddha? Why do you deserve to be the Tathagata, the great wheel turner? Why do you deserve to be this the generator of a world religion? And the Buddha takes his finger and puts it to the ground. He just touches the earth. And voila! Now we've got that's it when he reaches nirvana. That was it. Because, you know, I think, I always wonder about what that means. But I think that it just represents a person making the decision to fully embrace their autonomy. It was the Buddha saying, I deserve to be the Buddha because that's what I am. And in the same way, if you're a comedian or any kind of artist or any kind of creator and you're sitting around waiting for the Lord of the Earth to come and tell you that you're an artist or that you're a creator or that you deserve to make stuff, and you're not going to start putting yourself out into the world until that happens, then you're failing a test. You're failing an initiatory test, which is that eventually you have to make the decision that regardless of what this person or that person says, regardless of perceived results, regardless of perceived obstacles, regardless of whatever you think is standing in your way, you are going to make your art and you're going to do it even if it kills you, even if you fail in the endeavor. Because who cares? Everybody's going to die. Everyone on planet Earth is going to die. No one. I'm about to quote Jim Morrison, which is why I'm stammering because I don't want to. But no one here gets out alive. There's no way out of this mess that we're in right now. The only way out is your own personal extinction. That's the way it works. The Paris catacombs are filled with the bleached bones of the unknown dead who molder under there. Nobody remembers who they are. And many of them, no doubt, many of those skeletons, many of those skulls belonged to artists who waited for somebody to give them the go-ahead to make the stuff that they wanted to make. And they just croaked to the plague. And now they're down in the catacombs getting their pictures taken by pasty tourists blasting oyster farts into the darkness. Don't be one of those. Don't wait for somebody to tap you on the shoulder. Don't wait for somebody to tell you you're okay. Start making your stuff now. Just do it. All the technology is there for you, and it's the first time in the history of our species that this has been the case. All right? Okay. All right, guys. We've got a great podcast with Andy Kindler, brilliantly funny comedian, Bert Kreischer. He's been on the podcast several times. We're going to jump right into it, but first, some quick business. Okay, everybody. Now, it is my extreme honor to welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast two incredibly funny comedians, Andy Kindler and Bert Kreischer. And once again, this was recorded live from the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. Here they are. Open your third eyes, squeeze your pineal glands, spray as much astral love in the direction of these two divine beings, Andy Kindler and Bert Kreischer. Good evening, everyone. It is I, Duncan Trussell, the Skrillex of podcasting, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast being recorded live at the Montreal Comedy Festival. Everybody, please, a giant round of applause for Bert Kreischer and Andy Kindler. Let them hear it. Holy shit, man. As I was up there talking, all of that I was thinking is, I wonder in how many different ways Andy's about to make fun of me when he comes.
I don't mean that. No, you came to the wrong guy. I am Mr. Spiritual. I am Senor Inside. I am Dr. Obviously, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm with you.
You are very spiritual.
I always thought it was like, it's spelled like Gert Jeff, right? That guy?
Yeah, it's spelled like it's Gert Jeff, but you could pronounce it any way you want.
Yeah, no, but I was into Ram Dass and I was into Alan Watts.
Well, but Andy, you do something.
I can out-spiritual you, my friend.
I'm sure you can. But it's very interesting to me because you are, for those of you who don't know, Andy does this thing called the State of the Industry Address every year at the festival where he crucifies so many different,
so to speak, ladies and gentlemen.
So to speak. But it's like, you know, it's some of it's pretty brutal. It's always funny, but some of it's really brutal.
It's not always funny. I was here 2 years ago. Yeah. It's not always funny.
I've had some troubles. Let's not kid ourselves.
But I was there today, and motherfucker, he fucking killed. What was the joke? I tried to repeat the joke. Let's judge Jerry Seinfeld's joke on a scale of
who cares to I admit it's a sentence.
It was I said this to Andy, and I have to share this a little bit because I'm more than a comic, I'm a fan of comedy. I will always be a fan of comedy till the day I die. And I love the feeling of getting in the back of the room and getting let in, and they say, oh, sure, right over there. And you watch Andy Kindler just destroy Eddie Pepitone, who's walking out in a fucking, what did you audition for the role of, what was that?
Oh, I said, that's the role, Alfred E. Warren, the role of the guy who rips up ticket at the racetrack. Throws it down the ground.
It was destructive. And I said to him, I go, when did you start? Because he freeforms it at the beginning. And you freeformed it for at least 20 minutes.
Yeah, I never know how that's going to work. But you know, the other part of it is, I mean, there's not a cheat to it, but I do get to do anything that I've done over the year that relates to show business.
Right.
So I did this half.
So you've got
a
catalog.
Yeah, so whatever I wrote over the year that would fit the show, I try to open up with that so I know.
It was so fucking good.
But as a spiritual person, how do you balance this kind of like I don't want to call it mean, but this kind of like attack style of comedy with the idea of we've got to love everybody and be kind to everybody? Does that create any kind of dissonance inside?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I struggle all the time with, you know, and also it's, and the main thing is like, I think you have to be aware of what you're feeling. But I do think anger, I mean, Jesus wrote, again with the New Testament, Jesus rode through the temple, he got angry.
Right.
I'm saying I'm Jesus riding through the temple of show business. No. So, I mean, anger is an appropriate thing. And I think the thing is that if you try to be loving, it just doesn't work. You know what I mean? I tried to love Hitler. God knows I
Who has
it? Wait. How many people did you compare to?
Oh, well, my goal is to compare every comedian to Hitler. It started with Dan. I said the Dane Cook phenomenon reminds me of Germany in the 30s. There's a guy, he's screaming, all your friends like him, you don't understand. But Dane Cook is worse than Hitler because at least Hitler had a point of view. So that was the first year.
Wait, what was the one you did about Seinfeld today?
Oh, so Seinfeld, I said, I wasn't saying, though, I actually compared, I said, Bill Maher is just like Hitler, except Hitler didn't laugh after every joke.
It was so fucking good. I swear to God, that's the one thing in this festival that I'm so glad I get accepted to the festival to perform, because I get to go watch you do that. It
that
is
makes
so
me
fucking
so happy.
Good.
I have to go now, right? Ride this. No, I'm kidding.
No.
I mean, I have to go on the high. You got nervous there for a second.
Well, I thought you had to leave.
Well, I know, but it's not 11:30 yet. That's
not
but
yet.
Yeah.
No, you got plenty of time.
So, but okay, so never early say. That's what happened. You know, Jay Leno claims that he was on Dinah Shore, but I think Jay Leno lies about everything because he took it from somebody else. He said, when do you want us to play you off? He said, when I do this joke. And he did the word from the joke early, and they played him off. So that's what almost happened there.
Right.
But less funny.
That's the great thing about that State of the Union too, Duncan, is that you watch him run through his notes and you're like, too mean, too much about me.
Yeah, because there's paragraphs that you read them, you write them in like a month before or the night before or whatever, they sound like, oh, self, you know, righteous anger, and then you read it just looks terrible. And I never know what's going to work. I mean, I do know certain things, but I don't know other things.
Are there jokes that are funny that you won't say because they're too mean?
Well, by definition, I'm saying things that, well, I mean, the thing is, I was, I'll give you examples, like when I hang around like David Feldman, like sometimes comics to get alone will do bits that they would never do on stage because
right.
they would be too mean. So that's like, but that's just like you're almost like making fun of the form. But by definition, I'm trying to keep my targets high and all that kind of stuff. And I have over the years done material about people, and then I realize, well, why am I making fun of that guy? So it is something I think about a lot, about how mean it is. But I can't do it just on the basis of whether the target is – I mean, I can't just do it on the basis of they always have to be Leno. You know, it was just to be someone who's clearly horrible.
Right. No, I love it, man. I mean, it's one of, but it's like, don't you get dissonance? Like, it's like, I want to be mean. And sometimes, I feel like I'm not sometimes because, you know what haunts me, Andy? I did this Skype with Ram Dass once where, because he does this crazy thing where, like, you can do this heart-to-heart with Ram Dass. And I remember going on his website, signed up for it. Didn't think it would happen, and then out of the blue, you know, they schedule it, your phone rings, it's like, hey, it's Ram Dass, and then
yeah.
It's really intense, and then, like, suddenly he's, like, on your computer screen, and the guy just, like, beams love out into the universe.
Oh, so
it's
great.
Crazy.
Be like, here now.
He's a love radiator.
And yeah.
Even through Skype, you can feel it, but anyway, I was talking with him. I was actually with Natasha Leggero when we did this, and we were asking him about comedy. Like, what do you think about comedy? And he said, and I remember how my heart sank. He's like, he said, as long as it's not mean.
Right.
And it was like, ah, fuck, really? Like, you've deactivated so much of comedy is attack, revenge, getting your pound of flesh, and to remove that from the equation, it seems like it would hobble you as a comedian.
Well, he's like a hero to me, Ram Dass. He was, you know, he was originally Timothy Leary's partner at Harvard. And,
yes.
But I don't agree with every single thing that he says. And I also think, no, I really don't. No.
I thought you said Dennis Leary, and I went,
yeah, he was with Dennis Leary. And
I was like, that's so odd.
Such a weird, yeah, he was with Dennis Leary at Harvard. And but the point is that you have to make your own, it's like to me, I do think there's a part of life where, you know, the thing about Buddhism, Zen Buddhism that I really resonate with, it's not that you don't like things, But you try to, it's that you don't get attached. It's everything is something to be attached to equally. So that's why you don't want to get attached to the results of things. And Ram Dass talks about it. Everything can be a moment. Every moment is to be here now, you know, cooking, whatever. So I also think anger is part of that too. But he does tell a great story about when he went to his guru, Ram Dass, and the guru one day said to him, you have to lose anger, Ram Dass. And he goes, I do? Yes! So I thought, you know that guru guy that he...
Yeah, Neem Karoli Baba, who, by the way, there's stories of him, you know, that his guru yelling at people. And that's used as an example of how it's not about putting on this facade of being nice to everybody. Certain situations, you're supposed to get pissed off and be angry. But, man, you, by the way, I love your comedy. So I'm sorry if I'm like, well, why are you so goddamn mean, Andy?
But I know it's a very important question. It's not like I walk around not struggling with it, you know. But so much like when I've gotten bad feedback, it's been because the person's thin-skinned, and then they're trying to use certain people. Like, say, I went after Sandler. Well, Sandler's really thin-skinned, and he'll put the message, "Don't come after me."
You should probably put in some of your Sandler jokes right now. They were pretty good.
Well, I said Sandler. He has that movie out called The Ridiculous Six. Which is a takeoff of the Magnificent Seven, but require it literally. It's a name you come up with before you engage your brain at all. You know, how about the Crazy Nines, the 15, Fantastic Twelves? And I said Native Americans walked off the set because he had all these terrible names like Where's No Bra for the and Beaver Breath, and Native Americans walked off the set and they said they would prefer another genocide over.
Wow.
Oh, I'm the bad guy.
But here's the thing: is that it is. And I don't think people understand this sometimes. And in a weird way, I'll say this as a guy sitting in the room. And I know Andy and I barely know each other in life. We talk through Twitter and stuff. But, like, everyone in the room kind of hopes your name's in there.
Right.
You know? And I think
like,
there are people
it's respect.
Like
it's respect. When you talked about Marshall today, Marshall Books, a club in Atlanta that Andy works at.
He's here somewhere.
No, he's not. He's at to see Dave Chappelle.
What a dick.
But it's like, it's an art form. This is an art, and what he's doing is an art form, and it's respected by us. I don't know if everyone gets it, and maybe when you're the target, you don't. But man, it's like that reason we're all going to hustle to go see the roast battle tonight. Jimmy Carr is going up against the gay guy from Australia, and I want to see that. I don't care about my views on homosexuality. I want to see the artistry of comedy displayed in front of a crowd of people that judge it. Oh, fuck! That's what this morning was. Andy walked up. Jonathan Katz gave an introduction to him. And Andy walked up and destroyed people we look up to, our peers, and us in the room. And it's fucking awesome!
Yeah, it is. Well, there is something about it that's very cathartic. Because one of the inevitable feelings...
Oh, fucking Marshall just showed up.
Oh, there. We were
there
just talking.
Is. There he is.
Marshall Trials, everybody. The one aspect of, like, at a comedy festival, especially this comedy festival, you see this vector where art meets business.
Yes.
And that's a pretty fucked up place a lot of the time.
Desperate. It's very desperate.
Desperate and creepy, and there's a real palatable darkness there, which is why you're kind of like an exorcist when you go up there and start pointing these things out, because it needs to be said. It's really cool in that way.
Other part of it, though, is, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but that's my hook. How do I oversell everything? The thing is that the other part of it is that you have to get... My problem in life, and I've realized this, is that my spirituality, I believe, it's not like I believe in spirituality, it's just if you sing, or if you play music, or if you meditate, or if you do comedy, watercolor, you get into this zone that you can't explain, it's not something you're trying to prove, and you can feel it. Now, whatever it is, but to say there's no other state other than something, that, you know, I don't need a double-blind experiment to meditate, you know? And right. But why I get so angry at these new atheists, getting angry at them is right, because Bill Maher is a bigot. Look at that guy who killed these people today. When the guy killed the people in, was it Tennessee?
Yeah.
Bill Maher was like, yeah, we know what the cause was. What's his name? Because his name was Muhammad. You know. So, but a week later, he's silent when a white guy who says the problem is in America is all these immigrants. And he says nothing about it because his whole thing is the so you have to get mad. I have to get mad at it. But I get so mad because I still see my father who would fight with me when I was a kid. He wasn't trying to hurt my feelings, but I was so angry because I believed he was my hero and he was disagreeing with me about spirituality. So I'm still fighting that battle. So I think spirituality is getting angry but also having, and that's a big problem of mine, is letting the rage go and letting it, and that's very hard for me.
Yeah, that is hard. Anger is very, very problematic for me too, man. It's really destructive. You have to watch out. I would compare it to, it's like fossil fuels or something. It's like a spiritual fossil fuel. You can run your engine on anger, and a lot of comedians do. But God damn it, the end result is you get this kind of subjective global warming happening in your life where the end result of it after a certain period of time is like shit starts melting down. Like stuff around you ultimately gets a little misshapen.
Well,
you know, but
let me jump in as the opposite of that. And I did not want this to get
you don't seem like an angry guy at all.
I'm the happy fool. A lot of times. You can giggle. That's fine. I'm cool with it. I get drunk a lot, and I like to have a good time, and I giggle. I cried watching him laugh and tell jokes today. I cried. I fucking cried. Next to Ari, who's not a hard laugher. Ari's like,
Right.
I'm sitting there crying. I'm crying next to him. The difference is the happy fool internalizes his anger because you hear people take jabs at you all the time. Perfect example. I love this guy with all my heart, and I don't mean to subjectify him at all, but Todd Glass. Todd Glass is like me. We're happy fools. We like having a good time. We like giggling. We like fucking smoking weed and pretending that the weed may turn us into a different person. You know? Like, just like goofiness. Like, goofy right. fucking shit. But then we also become the easy target, and that anger is then resides in someone sometimes where you're just going like, do I ever voice this to anybody? Like, we were talking about this backstage. I have a hard time with confrontation. I have a really hard time with confrontation. So then you sit there silently. And that's why I love a guy like Andy and a guy like Jeff Ross and all the people who's doing the roast battle is because they're saying this shit that I couldn't do that. I could not do roast battle. I would be a fucking puddle of vodka the next morning.
Oh, God.
They say all the shit that I already think about myself. And I'd be like, how dare you?
Well, you're also bringing up a very, very good point. And the point is this. Like, I get a lot of my whole thing is like, I say these things on stage about Adam Sandler, but the other part of me is like, I certainly hope that's not going to affect my career at all. You know, so it's like, I can be like everybody else. But I notice there's a lot of people, they go through their whole life, and these people are like, well, I don't really. And your thing is, I relate to it, the confrontation, the non-confrontation thing. But there's other people who won't ever take an opinion on anything because there's like, what are you getting hostile for, part of our society? You know, and I think that's a thing that society does, not purposely like someone thought of it and they said make it a law, but it keeps you down and it keeps you from acting. And that's why people like Martin Luther King or Mandela or whoever or Malcolm X, and then you know, it's like there's different techniques for it. But there's a lot of people who never, ever confront anything. And not just confronting fighting, but they won't give their opinion. They won't say anything. And I think that all of it, and not in your case, but you know, the people who are like, I just like, no, I don't know. I hear you, but I don't really have much of an opinion.
Right.
I see both sides and all that stuff.
Right.
I used to think that was the cool way to be, but that's not a good way to be because that's a sheepy thing. Not you.
You can take me.
No, because you don't want to be. I know what you. I hate the confrontation. My wife has to call up and say you ruined my husband's shirt in the dry cleaner. And I'm like, you know what? Thank you for doing the shirt.
My wife does that for me, too. Yeah. My wife will be like, I'll be like, I'm not sending this back. She's like, it's overcooked. I go, just leave it. I'll eat it. I don't care. And she's like, let's send it back. You ordered a filet mignon. It should be medium rare. And then I go, don't worry about it. I'll just eat it. My wife's like, fuck it. You're a fucking bitch. And I'm like, okay.
Do you think of yourself as an activist? Are you an activist?
Me?
Andy?
Oh,
let me go first, Andy. Go ahead.
I guess I had an image of you. We must. I mean, it's a weird word in a way because I don't go on a lot of marches. I don't
go on a lot of Twitter marches, though. Like,
that's not a good
marches.
Sign.
Yeah.
I don't go
marches.
On a lot of marches.
Marches are pretty outdated. Marches are pretty.
It just sounds like a Twitter profile description. I go on a lot of marches.
I enjoy marching. I enjoy my walking papers. No, I am in that sense, and I really am. I got it from my mom. I absolutely won't let stuff go. I won't let stuff go. People hate me for the new atheist thing. They hate me. I know they hate me about it. And I am annoying. I admit that I'm annoying. But I'm not going to get away with people saying that asshole's not a fucking bigot.
Well, yeah, it feels like you're doing it. When I watch your...
the way you said it. I don't go in a lot of marches.
Well, yeah, that's what I think of an activist. I don't have a clipboard. I don't have a bank of phones.
I don't go in a lot of marches either.
Bank of phones.
March.
I don't have a 501.
You've never been to one march.
I've
don't
never
believe
been to
that.
Fucking march.
That's amazing.
What would I talk to those people about? What are you guys here for? I don't go to a lot of marches.
I'm marching.
That was so fucking funny the way you did it, though. But that's the beauty of a comic is that they don't know they're being funny. He literally went, I don't go to a lot of marches.
Well,
I'm sorry.
That is a... Well, I ask, always ask how much marching is involved in any cause.
Is this a sit-in or a march?
Yeah, how are we doing? What are we doing with this?
Have you ever been
eating?
Have you ever done, like, a sit-in or a march?
fucking have a stroke.
During the Vietnam War, but I was a little kid. I did a lot of marching.
What about, remember when we were about to go to war with Iraq? Did you go to any of those marches in L.A.? Remember those?
Oh, no, I just cried in my house. You mean the second war, right?
Yeah. Remember that? There were these crazy marches. Yeah. Man, that was crazy. I went to one of those. That was pretty intense. The energy was so weird because it's a country that doesn't want to go to war, trying to come to terms with the fact that it doesn't appear that it's a democracy and that there's no way to stop it. And all these people are marching, and the energy is very sweet but tragic because you know it's not going to stop anything. But I remember, man, as we're marching this way, some weirdo, some big muscular guy is walking the other way and elbowing everybody that he passed, like violently hitting people. And you realize, like, Jesus, that is a demon. Like, that's a person who maybe even is with the government. Like, maybe that's a person who got sent there to make it a little uncomfortable. Then the cops come, and they're wearing the new cop outfit. Because, like, back in the 60s in the Vietnam marches, the cops weren't dressed like Darth Vader, right? They were wearing, like, more, like, normal police officer clothes. Now the police come out. Yeah. They're dressed like Darth Vader. They've got batons and tear gas. And the message that it sends is, we are not you. Don't think that we're you. Like, whenever you see that shit happening, it reminds me of, like, when you finally get to the very edge of the wall in the Truman Show. Like, when you finally get to the very perimeter of where society can be, the guys in the fucking Darth Vader outfits come out and they beat you back until you just forget, like, okay, go to war. We can't do anything about it.
Right, but, you know, here's the thing. And here, when you're talking about how angry you get and all this and this kind of thing, the reason why, like, people like Oprah or The Secret, they totally miss, you know, they're twisting older concepts that actually have validity to make it like, oh, you want to do something? You just like Tony Robbins. I was in a plane with a guy with a Tony Robbins thing, and he was like saying, I said, have you ever been to the comedy festival? He goes, I hope to go. I mean, I know I will go one day. So it's like those people. But right. the idea is that you can control. You can't. I do think that at some point I have to turn the TV off and I have to disconnect and I have to breathe, that it's not healthy for me. The anger is good, but if I'm just all day believing that my life is controlled by these events, that I believe is a misunderstanding of, because most of the time, if you really think about it, nothing horrible is happening to you, even if something is happening to someone else, but it's that anticipatory fear,
right,
that it's going to happen to you.
Catastrophe thinking.
You get that, Bert, right? You're haunted by that, right? Which is interesting because your career is based around putting yourself in catastrophic situations, which is really curious.
That's the thing. I can't believe he doesn't like confidential. He's so brave in those things.
I said to this young girl, I'm not very liberal. I'm like regular liberal. Like, I don't say the N-word. But like, well, I mean, I'm just saying like regular.
The
like,
M word?
Oh well, yeah, just, that is.
No, I guess that was a bad one. No, but like I don't say any of the M words or the F words. Like I'm pretty like liberal and I want everyone to be happy. That's all I want. But my problem is it's like people say you scream like a girl, and I started hearing that as like offensive because I have two little girls, offensive to little girls. And then I got this like stance like don't say that like to people. I have my toenails painted, you can't see it, and people always go, oh, what's up with that? And it's like my canary in the mind of like how homophobic people still are. I go, I'm just a dude with painted toenails. I'm not sitting here blowing a dude in front of you. I'm just painted toenails.
You're not going the whole route.
Well, I don't even know why we started talking about this, because now I'm lost because I'm kind of drunk. But
I like where it ended up, man. Yeah, you got painted toenails.
I painted my toenails with my daughters, and I don't why.
No, well.
Well, does anyone remember?
Let's see him, Bert. Let's see him.
Well, the hard part is I have to put my fucking socks back on. I'm so fucking fat. So I paint my toenails.
Give those sweet toenails a round of applause, you guys.
That guy's got nice toes. Let's
I have
not
beautiful
kid ourselves.
Fucking feet. You I do. Have beautiful really fucking do. Feet. What's I have gorgeous eyes and beautiful fucking
you got
feet.
A great arch. What's the name of that color?
Electric blue.
Those your eyes are also electric blue?
My eyes are gorgeous.
No, they
dude.
Really are.
Fucking do you not notice the blue hat, blue toenails?
Unbelievable.
Blue jeans. Let me tell you something.
They make your eyes pop. It makes your eyes pop.
It does make my eyes pop. Not therapist. I'm in therapy right now.
With two therapists?
No, one therapist. He's doing good. Skype.
He's doing good.
Wait, you Skype with your therapist?
He's
Skype
doing good.
Yeah.
He feels okay.
He's doing right.
He was depressed when he first talked to me.
The reason he's doing good is the first meeting I said, hey, I might have a drinking problem. Let's not bring that up for a few things.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was like, I don't think you do, man. You got a stressful life. And I was like, fucking yeah, man. You're hired.
This is great. This is exactly. Act the way your beers are like you ordered them at the comedy store. The two-drink minimum.
Well, I don't have a fear of... I have a fear of running out of beers. That's my fear. Like, last night when they cut us off, I was like, what the fuck am I supposed to do? And then...
Right.
Yeah, but...
Well, but wait. You might... You probably do have a drinking problem.
Why are we doing this here?
Well, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Intervention time.
Here's the deal.
If you think you have a
drink... Stop it. Stop it.
Sorry.
Stop it.
Not with those eyes, though. Are you kidding me?
I think if I lived a regular person's life, I would never drink. I would probably never drink. But I think in the lifestyle we live... It lends itself to either overeating or overdrinking or smoking cigarettes when you don't know you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And it's like you're in Montreal. This weekend's bad. This week's been pretty bad. I'm shocked none of us have died. Like, because you get there and you just party and you're having a good time and you're having a blast. And you have people that are fucking hilarious. Who doesn't want to get a beer? I literally, when Andy was doing his thing today, I was like, why didn't anyone serve fucking beers? Like, this is perfect. I don't know. I think that if you look at me from your life as a lawyer, you're going, oh, that guy's got a problem. But I'm not a fucking lawyer.
But you're also gesturing with a beer can. I think that always... I tell you, I don't have a problem.
This is my Bill Clinton thumb. It's fun to get loose, I think, every now and then.
But that's why pots. I like pot.
Pots
get you loose.
I've never spoken much about pot, but I will say that I think it's fucking ridiculous that it's not legal everywhere.
It will be.
It
will be. But you know, man, to get back to your drinking problem.
Jesus Christ.
Come on,
no,
Duncan.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, we were fucking
no. on. But here's the thing.
It's not like he's lining them up.
By the way,
floor.
If you took a picture, like his socks off. If I had a drinking problem. If my therapist and my wife don't think I have a drinking problem, I don't fucking need to talk to nobody.
You shopped for the right therapist.
I think people's stigma, I think having or the idea of a drinking problem.
Yes.
In a lot of people's minds, they put it up there with having HIV or something. Like it becomes like, oh, a drinking problem. It's like having leprosy or some awful thing. But it really is.
By the way, I know the chick I got this from, by the way.
That's all, yeah,
Alex
it's contagious.
That you got what from?
My drinking problem.
You got it from a person?
Like it's a venereal disease.
Like it's HIV. It was one chick. I remember the day I got it.
Yeah.
Mike Osborne. This chick slept with my best friend. Are we going to be... You guys want to be honest? Let's be fucking honest.
Yeah, let's be honest.
And let's be uncomfortable. Chick slept with my best friend. I was in college. I'd only slept with two girls my entire life. I've only slept with six total. Slept with two girls. And she gave me the clap. And it fucking broke my heart. It just... Everything crumbled in front of me. And I didn't know how to deal with it. I really didn't. I really discovered anxiety and OCD. And my buddy Mike Osborne goes, "Hey, man, I don't know anything, but I know if you drink, these feelings go away." and we sat at Clint Munn's apartment and just started pounding beers. And I went, it's getting better. It's getting better. He's like, "I told you, man. Look, I'm no doctor. I'm no doctor."
Did you use penicillin, too, or just the drinking?
I had to stop drinking to...
Just to get that going.
Yeah, that's sad that I say that, but I'm sure people in here have had a venereal disease.
Sure, of course.
Something we're proud of.
Show of hands, show of hands.
Show of hands. Why won't we all be honest right now?
Let's do it.
What is that? What's wrong with that we all... I just said it. But no one will be like, "Me too." But
Don't do it.
But why is that?
Listen, everybody in here who has a venereal disease...
Not has, or had.
Or has had one. After this podcast, we're going to go on a march through the Montreal Comedy Festival.
Not all of us. Some of us don't like marches.
Will there be marching?
I just don't... You know, man, I think that I love the way, and I'm sorry I always bring up Ram Dass, you guys, but I love the way he talks about addiction, which is, it's like, you know, there's a lot of different schools of thought when it comes to addiction. You've got the AA school of thought. This is a progressive disease. There's no way out. Just gets worse and worse until you die. You got to stop drinking completely. If you drink, you're going to go in a downward spiral that's going to lead to your life exploding around you. That's like a really severe way to look at it. Whereas Ram Dass says being addicted to something is a great teacher. And if you're addicted to something, start watching the way you act and the way the addiction is controlling you, because it starts teaching you all this amazing stuff about yourself. And practicing mindfulness as you drink, as you watch the beer go up to your lips, as you like that first beer and you get that anticipatory weird feeling in your body where like, "Oh, I'm about to have a beer," and the excitement of it, and then the subsequent intoxication, and then the way you feel the next day. You just watch the whole system, and you watch it without judging it. And somehow, because the whole thing you're doing is like, "I don't have a drinking problem. Maybe I have a drinking problem. I'm guilty. I'm not guilty." Watch that too, because it's all part of the same cycle. And then from observing it in that way, it kind of starts fading away on its own. It starts falling away on its own. It's really curious. It's really interesting to try. I mean, I don't think having a drink... I think having a drinking problem is not a problem.
Keep saying it over and over.
I hear it a lot.
Look, don't feel bad about the drinking problem.
It's like
one
guy doesn't have a right arm and you keep going, right arm.
Look, it's a problem. Everyone knows it's a problem. I've seen it on Gawker.
I think I have a drinking problem. I think I have... I know I do. I love alcohol. If I'm not careful,
you
I'll
got
drink...
got this guy upset. I'm sorry, sir.
See you, man. I'm sorry. That's
it's like
my...
I have a clap and a drinking problem.
Never gets old. People leave. You assume things about
it. That's right. You do assume things.
You
do. I used to hate it. When I would go to comedy shows and like when I was at FSU, I'd like... someone would go to the bathroom and the guy would make fun of him. I go, "What the fuck's wrong with that guy?" And man, when I see people stand up, I'm like, "Oh, light up this motherfucker."
Yeah, he just had to pee. That's all.
Yeah.
And it is your worst nightmare as an audience member, because you're sitting there like, "Jesus, I have to piss. I think I can go right now. I'm not going to get noticed." And then the guy with the drinking problem is like, "What the fuck?"
Guy with the drinking problem.
Is that really your worst nightmare? Because I'm worried about getting rounded up like the Jews.
I guess that never. I don't want to get there.
I'm worried about another Hitler. Or Bill Maher.
Hey, but Andy, but you... Do you but it's kind of... When I see the stuff that you get angry about, the radical atheism that seems to
be... I hate them like poison. I hate them.
But it's singling out Islam. It's singling out Muslims. And it's saying that the entire thing is bad. Like, the entire thing is bad. If you look at the Quran, if you take it literally, there's no way around what it's saying. It's a insidious, evil religion that can only lead to a kind of theocratic totalitarianism.
Right.
And that if we don't start acknowledging the fact that that's what this is, then we're going to end up in this terrible apocalyptic war. And so they, you know, when they present their case, if you're not careful, you can find yourself getting drawn
into it. No question. I say this to myself. I'm never again ever going to try and argue with these people. And I actually don't, but I get into some kind of thing. And it's wrong. It's bad for me. Bad!
But it's spooky because it's because that kind of talk, it always starts off with talk. Like, I'm sure that before Hitler rose to power, there was just some talk about, you know, Judaism, these Jews. It's I don't know if they're... if they're trustworthy, it feels like the way they group together is like it's not. They're not contributing to society. They're taking away from society. We really should keep our eyes on them because I think the religion itself is not really good for society as a whole. And it just starts as talk. And it starts as fucking intellectual talk. It starts as smart people just throwing out these ideas in the laboratory of thought. And then the next thing you know, the thought becomes something a little bit more pronounced, and that's what's really creepy about what's happening with these with Islam and the anti-Islam, because it's like fundamentalist Islam wants people.
They love it. They couldn't be happier.
It's the best.
The people who are bombing things that we turn on everybody who's Muslim.
Because that's what they
want. That's what they want.
That's what they want.
That's what they're saying about us anyway.
That's what they want. And it gets really spooky when you consider that that culture, they're really good at war. That's a really old warring culture. Muhammad was a warrior. The whole thing is like very strategic and smart. And they are like, have you ever heard that like some in Japan, like they plan out centuries. They don't plan out years. They think centuries ahead. So if you look at that kind of concept of like a very long war, where some fundamentalist Muslims really do want the apocalypse to happen in the same way fundamentalist Christians want the apocalypse to happen. There's a lot of people who really want the fucking apocalypse to happen. And if you look at it from the POV of a group of people knowing that all they've got to do is a few more terrorist attacks here or there, just a couple more, and then all of a sudden that chatter about this is an evil religion is going to become more than chatter, and then the next thing you know, you've got a fucking world war based on religion, and that's an unwinnable war. That's the apocalypse, and that gives me the goosebumps. That creeps me out. So I'm glad that you're fighting back, but it's spooky when you just think that all it takes is one, like how many more? Three more? Like one more September 11th level event. That's all it takes. And that's it, right? That's pretty much it. That's going to be World War III.
I find it interesting that that's what you like about Andy's fight. And I love it because I go to his Twitter and I see him fighting with someone. I'm like, oh, I'll just read this chat thread.
Yeah.
I fucking scroll back and I'm like, it started with Jen Kirkman? Shut the fuck up. Like, she said something innocuous, Andy made a joke, someone jumped in, like hopscotch, like a stranger doing hopscotch.
It's awesome.
Not hopscotch, double dutch, and Andy just fucking lit him up, and I love those moments.
Well, here's the thing. I do want to say one thing, and I really think it's important, and I know I sound like an asshole sometimes, but here's the thing. Everything depends on where your point of view is. We are ridiculously stupid as a country. Like, we don't even know. Like one of my friends who did a graduate work in Iran studies couldn't believe what George W. Bush called Iran the axis of evil. When in 1953 we overthrew the government in I think it was Iran or Iraq, I forget which one, but it was Iran. But we've been meddling with these people forever. This guy like Richard Dawkins, he's a British colonialist. They see this guy slamming him. He's the same people who were British Petroleum in 1900. There's the Inquisition. Everything depends on your point of view. So now all these people, because I was always saying like, look, I don't know about Charlie Hebdo. I don't know. I'm not saying I love them, but just because everyone's saying I love them. And I was saying, you know, sometimes some of those cartoons could possibly be just racist. And they're like saying, people would always say to me, well, you shouldn't kill them. And I feel like, do I really have to make that statement to you?
Right.
Like I'm saying, oh, of course, I hope you don't think I mean we should assassinate cartoonists. No, we should not assassinate cartoonists. But to just say, like Bill Maher says, well, why are they getting upset about this? Because they live in countries where they can't wear a burqa. And when you see those pictures of Muhammad, because I heard Kurt Metzger talking once about how, well, those pictures of Muhammad, they're like, you know, it's not like a hook-nosed Jew. It's exactly like a hook-nosed Jew.
Right.
He's got his thing. There's one where he's got Muhammad's balls. What is the point of them tearing down Muhammad? Those people respect Muhammad. Muhammad didn't, this cartoon didn't do anything. And it's the same thing when people are like, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. But where were those same people when they wouldn't let them build mosques around 9/11? But comedians, they think of the, I don't want someone shooting me for my comedy,
right.
which is understandable. But put yourself in the position of someone who can't worship at a mosque. That's also freedom of expression. Vote for me.
Andy Kindler, everybody. Let him hear it. You're the best, Andy. So cool.
That way.
See you, Andy.
Thanks, everybody.
So leave us with that, Andy. We'll finish it up.
Wow. That's so intense. Yeah, I don't know, man.
I'm just still shocked that, like, technology-wise, they're still worried about cartoons.
Right.
Like, I haven't read the funny pages in a really long time.
Yeah, it's one of the
cartoons?
Yeah. Well, they
I'm
get
fucking
mad.
On YouTube, bitch.
They get mad.
Fucking, we're looking at cartoons? We're talking about, I feel like Allen Iverson, we're talking about cartoons? Who the fuck's reading cartoons? We're making fun of you on stage. You don't see that? Like, fucking cartoons? I'm fucking drunk.
That's okay. Man, I just think Muhammad was like, you know, like my mom didn't like to get her picture taken. And I think he was probably somebody who just didn't want to get drawn. And
no camera,
like,
no
yeah,
camera.
Yeah, I think he was like that. Happy, like, just don't.
Happy anniversary, put
yeah,
it away.
Yeah. That's the, man, that's why you just dream of a time machine so that you could go back and just have one 10-minute discussion with somebody like that, show him what the world looks like, and see what his reaction is. Because you get the feeling, you'd be like, oh, God, those idiots. I didn't mean it at all. That's not what I was talking about. But over time, it gets so watered down. It's like, this is something, have you ever heard of Abraham Maslow?
I was hoping you were going to say Lincoln. No, I haven't.
Man, he's got this wonderful breakdown of how human beings who actually, like, every once in a while, this is something Aleister Crowley talked about too, which is really cool. He said that if you look at our species as compared to other species, this is the only species that has like a super version that appears from time to time and creates like massive societal change. Like, as far as we know, like monkeys, orcas, any of the advanced species that have developed gigantic brains, there doesn't seem to be a Muhammad whale that appears and starts saying, here's the way we should all swim. And there doesn't appear to be like a Jesus monkey that appears and is like, we have to start forgiving everybody, even though Jesus monkey is a great fucking name for a band or a show, clothing line. Feel free to do it. But with humans, you get these emergent beings who have an experience that causes them to somehow become something more than just a human being. Yeah. Buddha, Muhammad, Jesus. And then what happens is those people get so lit up by whatever the thing is that they figured out that the people around them change too. They actualize too, because just being around a person who somehow has overcome whatever the boundaries are that keep us from merging into the whole, just being in their presence apparently is enough to like melt you down too, and then you become a disciple. And then once you're the disciple of this person, you carry that energy with you, and then you bring it to whoever you come around, and that energy moving down the line is something called the disciplic succession, is what they call it. And it moves from like, it's like a hot potato of enlightenment that kind of moves down the line. But then Maslow says that over time, that hot potato, it starts getting a little less hot and a little less hot and a little less hot, and then it turns into religion. And then when it turns into religion, it's just people repeating the same shit over and over again, but the energy isn't there at all anymore.
So, are people watching me get confused? By the way, you said the total opposite of what I thought you were going to say. What
did you think I was going
to
say?
I thought you said when it got to the warm potato, it was people like me that were like, yeah, I believe in something. I don't know what it is. And then you were like, it turns into religion. I was like, what? It's like, wait, how do they get it? Oh, fuck. I'm not following the potato.
Because it goes like this. Let me help you follow the potato. It goes like this. It goes.
So
like
Jesus made the potato.
So Jesus makes a potato. Exactly. Jesus makes a potato.
It's steaming hot.
It's nuclear fire. It's so hot.
But he can touch it because he's Jesus.
He's Jesus, yeah. He is the potato.
Jesus is the potato.
Jesus is the potato. And he, like, you get around him, and it's like, it's done. Game over. You get around the guy, your consciousness is going to get shifted, and now you become one of the disciples, and then you're somebody who then is spreading that energy down the line. So it's like, what somewhere down the line, what happens is, it goes from being, I'm trying to think of how it works with comedy. Okay, it's like comedy. To put it into perspective, you get Bill Hicks, right? This incredible, innovative, brilliant, amazing, revolutionary comedian, Bill Hicks, appears. And then all of a sudden, down the line, because of Bill Hicks, you get a lot of people who are kind of like Bill Hicks. And they're doing their own thing. They're super funny, but they're being honest. Like, Bill Hicks has opened it up so that now comics can be really honest and do these weird political rants. And it can go on and on, maybe without a big punchline in it even, but it's so raw and real that it's amazing. So then you get these other comics around Bill Hicks, but then eventually it becomes just a case of people imitating what they
just
think
a guy in a fucking in a duster and going like, I'm doing it.
Right.
But he's not doing it. He's just wearing a duster.
He's doing a kind of like pseudo angry thing where he rants about something that that seems like revolutionary or something, but it's like,
you're gonna hate this part of the question.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? I forget where we started. I know we started somewhere.
Well, but
it's not potatoes. The potato is an analogy for something we started about. I don't know what that was.
Man, you can never try to go back and figure where it started. Because, like,
this is why we need a time machine.
Yeah. Well, no, we're talking about the idea of, like, going back in time exactly to have a conversation with Muhammad or any of the great prophets to find out what they're really fucking like. Because my theory is they're probably the opposite of the way people think they were. My theory is that you get around people like that, and it's like being around, like, I heard a description once of a saint. Like, somebody who runs Ram Dass's foundation had gone up to India, and there's apparently a woman living up there right now who's like a realized being, whether you believe it or not. I don't know if I believe it or not, but I don't think that they have any reason to lie. I don't see why they would have any reason to lie. But there's a few people out there, and probably in other parts of the world too, that have, for whatever reason, they've created the chemical conversion in their mind where they're no longer attached to being a human anymore. They become something else. But this woman's name is Siddhi Ma. And he said that being around her was like being, and it sounds really strange, being around her was, you don't feel like you're with a human. It was like being around like a wild animal. It was like something that is so fully in the moment, so completely here, something so completely here that it's no longer a person. It's something where you don't know what she's going to do because she's fully in the moment. Whatever's coming through her is like the force of infinity. And that is way different than, like, I don't know, like somebody wearing a funny outfit with like a Bible and like making you repeat over and over again, like,
predictability.
Yeah.
It would be cool if priests were unpredictable. Like if they had the spirit inside them. And they were like, stop it! Everyone on your fucking knees! And you're like, whoa, what are we doing today?
I can guess!
I hope everyone appreciates that that we're not similar, but I love you. Like, I love listening. Everyone can witness. You're seeing my face. I get lost every now and then. But I love having friends like you, and I love these interactions, because I don't think, you know me, I called you from Hawaii that one time thinking I had testicular cancer.
Yeah.
And you were like, don't ever go into your brain by yourself.
Well, that's a Jack Kornfield quote. He says, your brain is like a bad neighborhood. You shouldn't go there alone.
It's like, I wouldn't have someone like you in my life. Like, it's the greatest thing to sit with someone who thinks bigger than I think. I'm a pretty meat and potatoes kind of guy. I'm in therapy and I'm working things out, but like I hear you talk about shit and I'm like, hot potatoes. Like, fucking, I'm going to put that into an analogy with my daughters. Like, and it won't be the same one. Your teacher's like a warm potato maker.
Thanks, man.
But it's like the greatest thing about you. I fucking, but I had to say that in the moment because I was like so overwhelmed by, I don't know, you guys were all here and you paid to see it or did not or whatever. But like you came to see him. And I got to be on stage with him. I just think that's cool.
Well, it's just fun to have these conversations, man. I think you're super smart. And I think that that's a weird thing that people do where they're like, oh, I'm not smart, you know, in this way.
Not like you, though. Well, like, you're different.
I'm not smart like you. That's the whole idea. The idea is, and well, you're, no.
You mean you can't get drunk in a mall while your wife Christmas shops by yourself?
I can't make that joke. I can't do what you just did. That's brilliantly funny, and so it's just a different kind of thing, man.
It's such a cool. I like. I hate to slug each other's dicks up here, but like,
let's literally do it. We'll make podcast history. You've already painted your toenails. Let's go for it.
If we did suck each other's dicks, would I do it good or poorly? Like, is the worse I do, the longer your dick's in my mouth, but the better I do, you're like, that guy's fucking good.
You know what, man? I bet if we do it, we'll definitely make it into Kindler's next State of the Industry address, for sure.
God damn it, that guy's funny. He does get hot about shit.
I like it.
I like it, too.
That's really cool, man. I love that. I love that, like, there's something about somebody who isn't afraid of confrontation, who likes to fight, or maybe doesn't like to fight, but just does fight. I find that very inspirational. And I, you know, because I think a lot of times people like to rationalize their cowardice. And when I say people, I mean me. Rationalize their cowardice by thinking they're spiritual. So they say, oh, no. I'm not afraid. I'm not abstaining from fighting because I'm afraid. I'm abstaining from fighting because I'm just too holy and sacred a person to do that. When the reality of the situation is, you're not. If you knew you would win the fight, you would fight it. That's a way you can tell if you're a coward or not. Like if there's a fight that you're withdrawing from, and you consider to yourself, wait, would I fight this fight if I was 100% certain that I would win? And the answer is yes. Then you're being a coward.
Well, here then, define this, because here's the thing I'm going through right now that I feel ashamed about. I end up giving advice to people that maybe aren't asking for it. Like, I find myself getting into preachy rants about advice. But it's stuff I actually know about, but like I give advice to people and I find it disgusting.
Why?
Because it's arrogant. Advice is arrogant. I get advice from people. I go, hey, you don't know me. Like, don't do that. I think maybe we talked about this the other day when we were fucked up. But like,
yeah.
I get advice from someone. I go, hey, easy, man. Like, you don't have all the information, but you are better than me and more successful than me in our business. But I'm on a different path, maybe, or maybe I'm not going where you're going, or maybe I need something else from my life. But like, I find myself fucking doing it. Like going like, here's the thing about managers. Like kids are signing with new faces or signing with managers. Here's the thing about a manager. What the fuck am I doing? Now, I do have great advice to give to a fresh face or a new face about signing with a manager. So I've been in the business for 16 years. But still, it's disgusting.
I don't think it's disgusting. God, Jesus, man. I'm glad people have given me great advice. Didn't think like that.
But how many people have given you fucking mediocre advice to hear themselves speak?
Yeah, but you forget about those people. Like, I don't remember that. I just remember, like, the people.
Only ones I remember. I don't remember the good advice.
Yeah, that's it. The shitty advice, you just forget immediately. But, like, sometimes when people, when I'm getting good advice, there's usually, I know it's happening because, A, it makes me feel uncomfortable. Like, whatever the advice is like, pushing me past where I think I should be. So it's like.
I see what you're saying. So, okay, let me preface this. I remember Joe giving me advice very early when I met him, and I didn't hear it as advice. I heard it as the truth. I was like, oh, that's what I need to be doing.
What was the advice?
I'm not going to talk about it.
It must have been great. Wow.
Great advice. It was great advice. Joe's advice was, I'll be candid about it, you're a very sweet guy that everyone likes, and you have a lot of people that love you, and you just need to accept us as friends. It was very, we had just done a shot of whiskey, and we had done the, you know, the Ice House Chronicles, or yeah. was pretty much, I was about to go on stage, and it was very sweet, and he gave me a hug, and I thought, I don't think I've heard that from a man ever. Like, I've never heard that from a man. Like, you're a very sweet guy, a lot of people love you, and you don't need bad things in your life. And I always thought that I deserved bad things. I think everyone thinks they deserve bad things. I look in the mirror and I sometimes go, oh, you piece of shit, whatever. And that's your conditioning of where your head's at. I remember hearing that, getting on stage, and I was kind of fucked up by it. I was like, wait, what's that mean? And then I got in the car and I was like, oh, he's a good guy. Or he's a good guy. You're a good guy. Joey's a good guy. And then I went into therapy right after that. I'm saying way too fucking much.
No, you're not. It's cool.
I went into therapy right after that, and Joey Diaz called me up. And he was like, dog. let's get coffee. And I said, I can't. I gotta go to therapy. He goes, dog, fucking cancel that shit. He goes, let's me and you hang out. We'll drink coffee and we'll talk. You don't need to pay anybody. I'll listen. And we remember me and you and Joey had coffee, and then we did a podcast. And that was like for a month. I sat with Joey every single day and had coffee. And I didn't think I really deserved good friends. You know, like Tommy Segura is one of my best friends in the world. I don't get to see anybody much. And so I remember that, hearing that from Joe, and I went, that's the best advice I'd ever gotten. Because I think I had surrounded myself by people that were maybe not, my interest in my life was not their interest. Like my happiness and my my success or my trajectory was not their interest. What I could give to them was their interest.
Right.
And Joe said, I had nothing. I remember him saying, like, if you have a date, let me know. I'll tweet it for you. And I was like, I didn't trust it. I really didn't trust it. I was like, I'm not fucking telling you anything. And then he was like, why wouldn't you tell me there? I could have tweeted it. And Joey was the same way. He'd come by my house with his fucking family. And we'd fucking sit in my front yard. And I just was like, what's going on? I was very shaky about that shit.
Isn't that weird? So it's like I'm right on the same page with you, man. It's really difficult to accept love. And that's one of the strangest aspects of being a human being. Because you'd think it'd be the opposite way. You'd think that you'd just be like, oh, great, love. Oh, friends, this is great. But for some reason, for some of us, probably not all of you, but for a lot of people, when it comes to you, you'll find yourself pushing it away.
And it seems like you'd automatically, on paper, Bert, someone likes you. In a weird way, my defense is, like, if any of you guys tonight will say, hey, that was a great podcast, you'll see it. You'll see it. I'll go... Everyone do it to me. but you'll see me, I'll go, oh, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Those are my words that I say. But I push it away because I'm like, I can't accept that. And even like friends, I go, oh, good, 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 good. But I'm waiting for you to hurt me. You know, like in a weird way, I'm waiting for you to hurt me. I'm waiting for that. It's fascinating because you'd think on paper, if you said, hey, you're going to be loved, I'd be like, well, fucking bring it. Fucking shower me with tongue kisses or whatever.
But this is... This is a funny battle, man. And, you know, I'll tell you very quickly about one of the coolest mushroom trips I ever had was when I was in college and I was really depressed. I actually got so depressed when I was in college that I got on antidepressants. Like, I had to get on antidepressants. It was awful. Like, I was having suicidal thoughts. I was, like, really, truly, deeply depressed. And I took mushrooms, which is not... maybe not the best thing to do when you're deeply depressed, but some people are saying it. They might cure depression, but I remember, or they might help depression. But I took these mushrooms, and I'm so gloomy, and I'm feeling so down, and the trip starts, and it's not a great trip. I'm walking through the woods, just bummed out, and then came out of the woods into this giant field of flowers near my college. It was the weirdest moment because all of a sudden it's like I could feel the entire universe was made of love and that it was pouring in on me like through the flowers. It was just love, 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 love. And it was like the universe was saying, you're the last part of the universe that doesn't love yourself. You're the last piece of the universe. The entire universe loves you except for you. And you've got to be able to accept it, and not just accept it, but be it. And the moment you do that, then it's a party. Like, it's become, now you're in heaven. But until you can do that, as long as you keep this membrane up between you and all of this, like, tsunami of love coming in at you, you're going to feel sad. Yeah. You're going to feel like somebody standing in front of the most delicious meal that anyone ever ate, starving to death, who is, for whatever reason, thinks there's an invisible screen between you and that delicious food. It's really cool, isn't it? And this is why they talk about the concept of surrender, which is in so many different religions. They say, you've got to surrender. You've just got to surrender. And we hear that, if you're depending on what kind of family you're raised in, the term surrender has very negative connotations associated with it. You don't want to surrender. Losers surrender. You don't want to surrender. But this concept is, you're surrendering in the battle of fighting against love. You're saying, all right, I give up beating back love in the world. I'm putting down my weapons, and I am now going to be completely enveloped by the great, transcendent, eternal love field that the entire universe is composed of. And it's a really scary thing, because when you do it, you cease to exist. And that's kind of scary for a lot of people, because it means you merge into this, like, ocean, and it's terrifying. It's better to feel like you're starving and have a self than to not be starving anymore and become everything for a lot of people. You know what I mean.
All I could visualize was like a meathead Jersey guy who was jealous and couldn't accept the love his girl gave him because he was so hot. She was so hot. And he was like, what the fuck are you talking to her for? What the fuck are you talking to him for? What the fuck? And that's the surrender. I was like, just let it go. She loves you. Just be her boyfriend.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And you could do it in every single thing.
I'm not the smartest person.
Yeah, you are.
But like, the way I see things are pretty basic sometimes. But like, it was all Jersey Shore. But like, yeah, I see it. Like, I don't know. I'm in therapy. I'm very happy I'm in therapy. I love it. I love it. I'm learning so much about myself. And I didn't like it before. I fucking hated it.
So how long have you been in therapy for?
Probably like a day. No, I've been in since I fell off that waterfall. So probably like a couple months, a few months.
By the way, being friends with Bert is like being friends with a pirate, because he's got pirate level adventure stories that I'll never have one. I like, if I could just have one, like, yeah, that was the time I fell off the waterfall. But that'd be amazing. But you've got fell off the waterfall, almost died scuba diving.
Rupture my nut.
The classic pirate story of rupturing your nut.
Drinking goat's blood with a Maasai chief. Like, it's been...
Knew about that one.
I drank goat's blood with a Maasai chief. This is a good story. He told me... the chief's in Tanzania. And we get in access to his tribe. And the chief pulls me aside. I got the whole crew with me. I'm the executive producer of my show. So we roll in and he says... It's an honor to meet you. Because we're shooting a TV show in his village. You know, I was like, it's an honor to meet you. He brings me over, and he cuts a goat's throat in front of me and bleeds it into a horn. And he says, it's a welcoming ritual. I want to welcome you into my tribe. Drink it. And then he gives me goat's blood. I'm like, motherfucker. Like, blood in Africa is not a good idea.
No.
It's like maybe like top five worst ideas. Literally, I'm like, does anyone fuck this goat? Like, I'm not even being crass. I'm being honest right now. I'm about to drink the fucking blood. That's what was going through my head. So I'm like, and like his whole tribe's like, drink it. And so I drink it, and then he drinks it, and he says in front of his whole tribe, he's got his posse behind him like the Wu-Tang Clan. He goes, how are you famous? And he doesn't know any better. I'm like, fuck yeah. He goes, big time. How did you become famous? Now, I have a spiel I give people when you go, how did you, like, tell me your story. I was very quick, I can tell you. In 1997, Rolling Stone magazine called me the number one party animal in the country. Oliver Stone optioned the rights to my life. That began the movie Van Wilder. Will Smith discovered me after 6 months of doing stand-up, and I started doing TV. And I've been doing TV for 16 years, and I'm on Travel Channel. I've been there for 6 years. It's the greatest job in the world. I take people on adventures of a lifetime, and now I'm here and I'm meeting you. And he says, wow. I said, how did you become chief? He says, when I was 12, I killed a lion. Fucking, I I watched the Wu-Tang Clan behind him be like, oh shit, bitch! They start doing that stuff to each other, and my television crew is like, tell us how you killed a lion. I was like, fuck you guys! And then he's, you want to hear it? It's a good story.
Yeah.
So in Tanzania, in a lot of places in Africa, they don't do circumcision until they're like 13, because they do it in front of the whole tribe. They cover them in mud, and they circumcise them with a fucking rock, a sword, and a stick in front of the whole tribe. And if any of the mud on their face cracks, then they're shamed and they can't live inside the tribe. They can't marry any of the women from the tribe and they're shunned.
Wait, you mean, okay, so if they have if they make an expression.
Any expression.
Wow.
Fuck. He's telling this goddamn story after I told him I was in Rolling Stone.
You think he even knew what Rolling Stone was?
I fucked up. I should have made it bigger, like BBC or something he knew. And so, the day before you're circumcised, you're set outside the tribe to kind of reflect about the day you have tomorrow. And so he goes outside the tribe, and a fucking lion rolls up on him. So he climbs up a tree, and a lion climbs up the tree. He takes a sword. They're all given a sword at a certain age. He takes a sword, and he cuts the lion, and the lion falls out of the tree and dies. He then takes the lion, makes sure it's dead, throws it over his shoulders, and the next morning rolls into fucking camp with a goddamn lion over his shoulder.
Wow.
Like fucking The Rock in the movie nobody saw. And... And then he says to me, this motherfucker says to me at the end of the day, here is that sword. He gives it to me. He hands it to me.
What?
He gave me his fucking sword. And I go, and I was like, oh, thank you. And then he looks at me. I can see it in his eyes. He's like, what do you got for me? It's like, you can't give a present and not get a present. I wish this story was better in the ending of this. I wish I, because I, in my head I was like racking my brain. I was like, do I give him my cell phone? Like, oh, by the way, I did show his whole posse porn on accident. And so I was like, do I give him my cell phone? But he didn't have a charger. They don't need their Wi-Fi. And all I had to give him was a fucking football. I gave, we had a football. And so I just handed him a football. He was like, thank you.
Oh, man.
So I got this awesome Maasai.
You got a magic sword. Like in a video game, that'd be like a +8 sword. A holy sword, and you gave him a fucking football.
A fucking, not even a leather football, like a rubber football?
Here's what I think. This will ease your mind. I have a feeling that this chief has like a whole cabinet filled with swords, and anytime a white person...
By the way, I gotta tell you, I'll show it to you next time you're at my house. It's a weird color to sword. Like, yeah. Like you're like kind of like, because it's like a mauve. Is mauve the right color? It's like almost pink, but red, but like big.
Mauve.
Wait, did a black guy just yell mauve to me? Motherfucker! Shelve your fucking stereotypes! Mauve, bitch!
But it's so funny, though, to imagine as you guys are coming, him and his friends are like, are you going to do that lion trick? Because it got us a VCR last time.
It got us a VCR.
Yeah.
Hey, tell the lion story. Give him that fucking bullshit sword.
Bert Kreischer, everybody. Give him a round of applause. Bert Kreischer.
I had a fucking fantastic time tonight, Duncan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This episode was brought to you by Harrys.com. You can go to HARRYS.com to order some fancy gourmet level razor blades. And if you use offer code Family Hour, you'll get $5 off of your first purchase. If you enjoyed this podcast, I hope you'll give us a nice rating on iTunes, subscribe to us, use our Amazon portal, and most importantly, use whatever portal you must to connect yourself to whatever force it is that is creating all life and matter in this universe. I love you guys. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No